You know, Advent is a time of mixed emotions, isn't it? This holiday season. And for some people, it's just joy and nostalgia and generosity. And for others of us, it's a time of anxiety and overwhelm and disorientation. And I know enough stories in this church to know that in this room, you all bring the whole spectrum of those emotions in this season. Some of you are full of joy. Some of you are full of grief. And the thing about Advent is all of those are welcome. So if you find yourself fully celebratory, you are welcome in the season of Advent. And if you find yourself in a season of disorientation and grief, you also are welcome in this season of Advent. It gives space for all of that. It doesn't rush us straight to Christmas. It makes us yearn for that holiday. So the series we're doing this year for Advent is called Deep Longing. It goes along with our deep and wide theme year, but it reminds us that this is not just about the emotions that we have in the moment, because those are fleeting. They're real and valid, but also fleeting and surface level. What does it mean to have deep hope and deep peace, etc.? Those things that are rooted more strongly and aren't about how life happens to be going in the moment. Fleming Rutledge, a prolific writer and author, says that Advent begins in the dark. It's not with all the tall trees and the twinkly lights and the bows, but instead, the season begins with darkness. We celebrate the themes of hope and peace and joy and love, but in medieval times, their four themes for Advent were death, judgment, heaven, and hell. So to the Reed family, aren't you glad you didn't get an email asking you to light the death candle today? Those themes might seem bleak, but they are in some ways appropriate for a time of waiting. And in the era before the coming of Jesus, there were some bleak times for God's people. They were in seasons of oppression. They were in a dark tunnel with no light at the end. It was just sin and defeat and oppression and judgment, rinse and repeat. It felt to them, I'm sure, like complete darkness. Sometimes for them, the darkness had the name of a foreign nation: the Egyptian Empire, the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire. Might have had those names. Sometimes for them, the darkness had the name of one of their own kings, like Manasseh or Omri or Ahab. Sometimes their darkness was just their own sin and idolatry and injustice. But whatever the name and the cause of their darkness, they found themselves in it, and it all felt the same. It felt like defeat and abandonment and loneliness. And so we find the prophet Isaiah writing to God's people in the midst of this tunnel of darkness. In Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, we read this together a moment ago. The prophet says these words: "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned." Then the prophet goes on to speak of their future as if it has already happened. He talks about God increasing their joy, and God shattering their burdens and defeating their enemies and burning their weapons. And then after all this bombastic, militaristic imagery about some cosmic defeat, Isaiah softens his tone and says, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever." So because of this baby, this child that is to be born, light will replace darkness, joy will replace death. Deliverance will replace oppression. And the ultimate cause for all this, it's not some huge victory where we're burning the spears. The cause is the birth of this little baby, the new ruler. And so Isaiah says that God, through this human king in David's line, will create a wondrous new possibility for the people that is unconditional and unqualified. But this event does not preclude the suffering that will continue to happen. First, there will be pain and despair, but then hope. First, oppression, then deliverance. So when I read these messages of the coming ruler and think about this Advent season, I'm reminded of the contrast between optimism and hope. Optimism likes to do its work in the before. Optimism says, things will be okay. It's going to turn out all right. No, it's not going to be that bad. Oh, you know, you'll find someone else. Oh, I'm sure it's just nothing. Optimism just says things will be okay. And one writer says, nothing says I'm not listening to you quite like offering reassurance. Optimism is a good quality. I prefer that to pessimism. But optimism has a limit. And the limit is because we know otherwise. We know that sometimes it isn't going to be okay in the short term. We know that sometimes things aren't going to work out the way we had wanted right now. We know otherwise. Mary McKibben Dana says that when the facts suggest otherwise, optimism just isn't enough. And this is when hope comes in, rolls up her sleeves, and says, optimism, take a seat. Hope is deeper than that. Hope plays the long game. And so in a very simplified way of my thinking, I think that hope is sometimes about the thing after the thing. It's the delight after the suffering. It's the plans to prosper you and give a hope and a future after the 70 years of exile. It's the birth of a new ruler after a long season of oppression. It is the resurrection after the death. So hope might look huge and cosmic, or it might look like a little baby. Hope might look like taking the long view of courage in the face of a daunting journey. I want to take a few minutes, and I want you to hear from one of our members, Roz Ekman. As you know, Roz has been facing cancer off and on for 5 years. And so I sat down with her recently to talk about what hope means when hope might not mean healing from what she's dealing with. So watch this video.
My name is Roz Ekman, and I came to Dallas from Lubbock in 2008. Had been to Broadway Church there in Lubbock and knew I needed to make sure I had a church family here. I went several places and kept coming back to Preston Road. The rest is history. I was born in Northern Ireland and came to Houston in 1971. So I've been here since, on my 22nd birthday, I had a one-way ticket to Houston, Texas, and there I am. I was married. We worked at a congregation in Houston, just in a city. Jim was a bus ministry, youth minister. Then we went into preaching, worked in Bonham, Texas, Earth, Texas, Hollis, Oklahoma, and Altus, Oklahoma. And then I came to Lubbock in 93. I was first diagnosed in July of 2019 with pancreatic cancer. I was getting ready to go on a trip to Ireland. My daughter had planned all this for my 70th birthday, and we were going to have this trip and see my brother. And deciding, okay, am I going to make this trip to Ireland? And I said, yeah, I am. So on the 26th of July, I made a trip and went to see my brother. As soon as I got back from Ireland, I started within 3 days, I started chemo. And the plan was to do 6 chemo, do the Whipple surgery, which I'm sure people are familiar with, and then six more chemo. So after two chemo rounds, I had an emergency gallbladder. And then 3 weeks after that, I started back into my chemo and recovered well. And then came COVID. My family couldn't come in. My work family, my church family, everybody was such a help to me, which is the first, I would say, not the first, but where you see God's people step into action, and your friends, and when family cannot be there. And I just took a day at a time and decided I was just going to live every day. And then in December last year, it decided to reappear. But then we did biopsy and we decided, I went back and forwards and I wrote all these questions. What if I do this? What if I do that? And I decided chemotherapy was not how I wanted to spend the rest of my days. And I decided, well, let's take my pancreas out. And so we did, which automatically made me a type 1 diabetic. You know, I'm trying to be very disciplined. I eat within a certain period of time. I try to stay on focus. But I've decided I'm trying not to let it control me. I'm controlling it because I want to live. I'm living every day. The hardest part for this is watching my children, and I can't fix it. I still believe that we have a God of miracles, and that's who I believe in. And so we've just got such a promise of what God's got in store for us. So you have to have that hope. Never give up. Our God is a God, as I said, that works in miracles. I don't know what he has in store for me, but I think he's using me. And I think anybody, you can't give up. But Isaiah 41:10 says, don't be afraid, for I'm with you. Don't be discouraged, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will hold you up with my victorious right hand. And then in 13, it says, for I hold you by your right hand, I, the Lord, your God, and I say to you, don't be afraid. I am here to help you. And I think about, do you remember reaching out and holding your mother's hand or your father's hand? Me and my daughter, we still walk holding hands. And so I know I've got that comfort and strength, and God's just going to hold me by the hand. Yeah, well, I'm going to be healed either way, either here or afterwards. Hope is I'm human and I want to spend as much time with my children and my grandchildren as possible and my friends and family. There are no words to describe my thanks and what a blessing they've been to me.
I'm so grateful that Roz shared her story with us. What an amazing outlook of hope in the midst of a time of suffering, even in this holiday season, and the simple things that she reminds us of, that give us hope. So it may be that Advent begins in the dark, but a light has dawned. And in a large way, that is what we look forward to these 4 weeks as we lead into Christmas. It's the thing after the thing. But along the way, there are lights that give us hope. Sometimes those lights are hard to see. Sometimes they're just the twinkly things on our trees and in our wreaths and along our rooftops and all over our city. Sometimes that's what those lights are. Sometimes they illuminate the South Dallas sky as they sit atop a building that oversees people being nursed back to health and given their own hope. The light shines in the darkness. And the darkness has not overcome it. Let's stand and sing.